The headlines: Iran slams the US for vowing to keep the pressure on the International Atomic Energy Agency about Tehran's nuclear program, calling Washington's policy, quote, extremely harmful. China says the US practices on human rights have demonstrated to the whole world what textbook human rights hypocrisy looks like. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah condemns Morocco's normalization of ties with Israel, saying such regimes will reap nothing but disappointment. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour: Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency has slammed the US for calling for pressure on the agency regarding Tehran's nuclear program. In a tweet, Kazem Gharib Abadi said the U.S. pressure on the IAEA is detrimental to the interests of the entire international community. Gharib Abadi called on the agency to withstand Washington's pressure and remain independent. He cited June 2019 comments by the late Director General of the IAEA, who had described attempts to put pressure on the body as counterproductive and extremely harmful. The Iranian envoy said it is now clear what Yukiya Amano was talking about. This comes after U.S. Special Representative on Iran, Elliot Abrams, said Washington should coordinate with the European signatories to the 2050 nuclear deal to keep pressing the IAEA regarding Iran's nuclear activities. Tomer Ezgi says Iran has time and again stressed that the IAEA should not turn into a political entity under U.S. pressure.
This is something that Iran has been mentioning again and again in statements that have been delivered by the Iranian ambassador himself to the IAEA's Board of Governors, that there is pressure on the agency when it comes to Iran, and that the agency should remain independent and impartial and professional, should not turn from a technical organization into a political entity. And in the reference that he made to the remarks of Yukiya Amano, the late Director General, he had also made the same remark. He had used the word micromanaging, saying that there is an effort to micromanage the agency without at the time mentioning any country or person specifically. And now Mr. Gharib Abadi saying it's clear from these comments who Mr. Amano was referring to. It was the United States who was trying to do that, and it's continuing to basically dictate the policies of the IAEA, especially when it comes to Iran. This is the Iranian position on this issue.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry has dismissed U.S. Condemned criticism of Beijing's human rights record as blatant hypocrisy.
The U.S. practices on human rights have demonstrated to the whole world what textbook human rights hypocrisy looks like.
The remarks follow a social media post by the U.S. Embassy in Beijing regarding human rights in China. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson stressed that under the gloom of the COVID-19 pandemic, people's right to life is the most important of all human rights. She described the coronavirus-related fatalities in the United States as shocking and saddening. Beijing says it always puts human lives first and makes the best possible efforts to protect their safety and dignity. Elsewhere, Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has condemned Morocco's move to normalize ties with Israel, pledging continued support for the Palestinian cause. Hezbollah branded normalization deals with Tel Aviv as treacherous steps in line with the U.S. and the Israeli regime's desire to eradicate the Palestinian cause. The resistance movement said Morocco and a few other Arab states have normalized ties with Israel will gain nothing but disappointments from submission to U.S. and Israeli blackmail. Hezbollah also warned that Muslim nations continue to reject all forms of normalization with Israel and will ensure the deals will fall apart.
Morocco has become the fourth Arab country to normalize relations with Israel since August in a U.S. brokered agreement. U.S. President Donald Trump announced the agreement on Twitter Thursday. He said Rabat and Tel Aviv have agreed to fall diplomatic relations, calling the move a historic breakthrough. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also called the deal historic. Morocco said under the agreement it will take concrete steps to resume a relationship with Israel on several levels. In return, the U.S. decided to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over the entire Western Sahara. The Polisario Front independence movement that holds a fifth of the region strongly condemned the deal. The movement said Trump has attributed to Morocco something that does not belong to the country. Palestinians denounced the agreement too. The Palestine Liberation Organization said Morocco's decision was unacceptable. It said the move will increase Israel's belligerence and its denial of the Palestinian people's rights. Resistance movement Hamas said Israel uses every new normalization deal to increase its aggression against Palestinians. The Islamic Jihad movement also denounced Morocco's decision as a betrayal to the Islamic and Arab world. In Yemen, the Ansarullah movement said there isn't any justification for Arab states to establish ties with Israel. Inside Morocco, many people are critical of normalization with Israel. During a demonstration in the capital Rabat in September, protesters called Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates treacherous countries for establishing diplomatic relations with Israel. Many believe U.S. brokered normalization agreements aim to eliminate Palestinians from the entire region.
Israel doesn't want peace. Israel wants territory, power, and it wants genocide. It wants to eliminate Palestinians, preferably 100%, if not by killing them, then by making them forget that they're Palestinian.
The UAE announced its decision to establish diplomatic ties with Israel in August. In return, Washington provided Abu Dhabi with F-35 fighter jets. Bahrain and Sudan followed suit, with Sudan being removed from the U.S. blacklist of terrorism-sponsored countries. On Thursday, White House senior advisor Jared Kushner said a similar deal is inevitable between Israel and Saudi Arabia. For now, it's unclear what privileges Riyadh will be given to normalize relations with Tel Aviv.
Let's return to one of our earlier stories regarding China, which says the U.S. practices on human rights have demonstrated to the whole world what a textbook human rights hypocrisy looks like. This comes after the U.S. Embassy in Beijing denounced China's human rights record. Get some reaction on that. And let's cross over to Beijing, joined there by Aina Tengen. He's an author and columnist. Mr. Tengen, what do you make of China's arguments here?
Well, there's two things going on. One is a fundamental disagreement about what human rights means. In the United States, in Europe, human rights are basically political rights. It's a ballot box. It means that you have to have a democracy, and also that you have the ability to speak your mind politically. Now, it's not always clear that that is observed in these states. Now, for China and most of Asia, human rights relate to things like public safety. And in a most recent article, there was a mention that 3,000 people a day dying in the U.S. because the government inaction is a violation of human rights. And that's because that's fundamentally how it's seen, to be safe in your homes, on the street, in your jobs, in your schools, anywhere that you go out in the public area. This is the first duty of a state to establish order. And then there's opportunity. Opportunity for jobs, for a better future, access to health care, education, these things. So that is the definition of human rights if you come to China and you talk to people on the street or at the government level. But very, very different from the way the U.S. and Europe sees it. The second part is that this promises to be an ongoing tension line. And it's not surprising that the embassy is trying to exacerbate this as part of Trump's belief that he can control things after he is forced out of the office on January 20th. So he wants to exacerbate this issue of human rights and tensions between the U.S. and China so that it's more difficult for a Biden administration to come to some sort of pragmatic way of dealing with the economy, the environment, health, peace initiatives, and multilateral trade. Initiatives. So what you see here is, as I said, two-pronged. One is fundamental, the other one is political.
Very interesting, Mr. Tengen. And, observers would say the biggest human right is the right to life, as Beijing had noted. And when it comes to, and I believe it's at the top of the Geneva Convention on Human Rights as well. And when it comes to the pandemic, China, you know, successfully contained it, whereas the U.S. essentially failed to protect American lives.
Well, yes, I mean, in China, I mean, like the Sichuan earthquake in the United States, if there's an earthquake, you know, people figure out how many people are going to die and just say, well, they're going to die, we'll do what we can. But for the Chinese people, they were greatly hardened when their premier said, no, the lives of the people come first. And they told the generals, I don't care what you have to do, that is the priority. And that's the same thing you see here today. For the Chinese people, it would be unthinkable that their government would not put their welfare first. And to them, as I said, that is the essence of human rights, the right to live peacefully and have opportunity. It's not the very few people in China, it's increasingly hard to find, believe that human rights begins with a ballot box or our unfettered political expression.
Right, yeah, that Sichuan, the earthquake there, I was actually in China, and there was an unbelievable unity that you saw in the country. But do you see double standards, Mr. Tengen, from Washington when it comes to, when it accuses other countries of human rights abuses?
Yes, of course. I mean, almost all countries have some degree of double standards, but the U.S., especially under Donald Trump, has been, basically morality, ethics, and the rule of law, although being preached, have been widely ignored. You take Ms. Meng's case. She's the daughter of the founder of Huawei. They basically seized her. This is a medieval act. You're trying to strike out at the company. You can't get to the main guy, so you kidnap his daughter and, in essence, try to use her as leverage. One would have thought that that kind of activity would not be, sanctioned by anybody in the world, but nothing. Nothing coming out of Europe, the United States, about the violation of her rights or anything like that. You have the unilateral actions, sanctions that have been put on without any evidence being forwarded other than, quote, it's a national security risk. They won't say why because it's secret. So, you keep having these ongoing situations where the U.S. is acting outside ethics, morality, and law based on this concept of American exceptionalism. For those who don't know, that means that the U.S. has the right to do anything in order to bring about a world that is a liberal, democratic, capitalist cookie cutter. And that is increasingly being resisted. The world is full of nations and cultures. They have different ways and beliefs and values, and it does not necessarily fit into this idea that it should all be one variation of something determined in the U.S., especially given right now where both pillars of American exceptionalism are under question. Democracy has not delivered the kind of governments that have been able to solve problems, and is right now is in complete disarray, as you have a president who obviously lost by massive popular numbers and by a lot of votes in the Electoral College, who is refusing to acknowledge it, seeking to overturn it. And yet this is the same country that questions other countries for doing exactly the same thing. And then you have capitalism. Capitalism is supposed to be more efficient because it, makes people compete. But right now, America has companies that are too big to fail, too big to rein in. When you start looking at these tech giants, they're looking at it. But increasingly, capitalism in America is pushed around by special interests, by, as I said, these large oligopoly monopolistic groups who dominate every major industry. So this idea that the American model is going to just deliver a panacea does not ring true either today or in the past. So these efforts to judge other countries based on a set of rules that they don't enforce themselves and are not working even in their own country, I would say that would be the definition of hypocritical.
Always good to have you with us, Mr. Tengen, and sharing your thoughts with us as well. Ina Tengen there, author and columnist, joining us out of Beijing. And in other news, Syria's envoy to the United Nations says the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has become a tool for the United States and its allies. Bashar Jaafari made the remarks during a video conference at the UN Security Council, where the OPCW accused Damascus of not declaring all its chemical weapons activities. Jaafari called on the organization to close Syria's file and highlighted the country's commitment to cooperating with the UN body. Russia's ambassador to the UN also rejected the OPCW's claims as speculations and political smear campaigns. Vesely Nebenzia said the UN body relies on remote investigations instead of on-site collections of samples. Russia and Syria also criticized the OPCW's past reports for serving as a platform for Western attacks on Syria. Correspondent in Damascus, Muhammad Ali, says the US and its allies' allegations against Syria are pretexts to carry out strikes against the country.
The Syrian government has cooperated fully with all of the teams throughout all of those years with the OPCW. Whenever they wish to come, they came. Wherever they want to go, they did. They visited all sites in Syria. They acknowledged that they destroyed all of Syria's chemical arsenal. So you can't rely on reports coming out from areas controlled by Takfiri terrorists in Idlib or any other area back over there still under the control of terrorists. You can't rely on reports that there are chemical substances used or any by the Syrian government or any chemical substances still at possession of the Syrian government. What should be done is that if there are any question marks, there should be teams sent to Syria, and Syria is cooperating fully. But we have to point out that those allegations, those are pretexts, according to many analysts, used by those countries, the United States and its allies, to continue accusing the Syrian government. And many times those accusations were used for carrying out strikes by those countries, like the United States and its allies, against Syria. So it seems, according to many analysts, that those countries do not want to give up, using this card, this accusation in the media or at the United Nations.
Elsewhere, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says talks between his country and the European Union over a post-Brexit trade deal are deadlocked.
The argument today is about the terms on which we trade with the European Union. And the issue at the moment is that talks in Brussels are stymied, deadlocked, because they want to keep us locked into a system by which every time they change their laws, we have to change our laws. And we don't think that's a brilliant idea.
Johnson said the British companies will enjoy big opportunities in the case of a no-Brexit deal. EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen also told EU leaders that a no-deal scenario is the most likely. Meanwhile, the Irish Prime Minister Michael Martin said his country still hopes a last-minute deal could be reached. And that ends our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
President Donald Trump's attempt at a victory lap offered a stark contrast to Joe Biden's somber yet ambitious event. The U.S. government's drive for a coronavirus vaccine was named Operation Warp Speed by Peter Marks, an official at the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, and a longtime Star Trek fan. A staple of Star Trek storylines is alternative realities, someone slipping through a wormhole into a parallel universe where history took a radically different turn. U.S. cable news viewers went through the wormhole at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, 8th of December. Two captains, two crews, two languages, one English, the other Klingon. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist David Smith. The piece is titled, Trump's Warp Speed Vaccine Summit Zooms into Alternative Reality. Stay with us for more of David Smith's article. President Donald Trump's attempt at a victory lap offered a stark contrast to Joe Biden's somber yet ambitious event. The U.S. government's drive for a coronavirus vaccine was named Operation Warp Speed by Peter Marks, an official at the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, and a longtime Star Trek fan. A staple of Star Trek storylines is alternative realities, someone slipping through a wormhole into a parallel universe, where history took a radically different turn. U.S. cable news viewers went through the wormhole at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, 8th of December. Two captains, two crews, two languages, one English, the other Klingon. Those watching CNN and MSNBC could see a somber President-elect Joe Biden opening his remarks by acknowledging the terrible COVID-19 death toll. More than 285,000 Americans dying in the U.S., setting out an ambitious vision for his first 100 days in office, wearing face masks, vaccinations, opening schools, and unveiling a healthcare team heavy on experience, science, and diversity. But those watching Fox News Channel and other conservative networks found President Donald Trump making no mention of the dead. In many respects, we're still doing incredibly with our stock markets and everything else, which are hitting all new highs. Trump boasted about the speed of the vaccine development and ranted lies about a stolen election. In what is now routinely described as a split-screen nation, the contrast was on the nose. It was also an unusual role reversal from the norm, with the outgoing president delivering happy talk and sunny uplands, whilst his successor offering a much darker vision and warning about trouble ahead. It was the latest of Joe Biden's team unveiling in his home city of Wilmington, Delaware. Speaking against the blue office of the president-elect backdrop, Joe Biden said bleakly, "Last week, COVID-19 was the number one cause of death in America. For Black, Latino, and Native Americans, who are nearly three times as likely to die from it, COVID-19 is a mass casualty. For families and friends left behind, it's a gaping hole in your heart that will never be fully healed." Meanwhile, over in Washington, in the South Court Auditorium in the White House, Donald Trump spoke against a less subtle background of stars and stripes, icons, and Operation Warp Speed written in block letters. His vaccine summit had been dismissed as a public relations stunt amid embarrassing reports that his administration passed on buying additional doses of Pfizer's vaccine. Despite a daily death toll now rivaling that of the 9/11-2001 terror attacks, Donald Trump began by taking a victory lap, praising Vice President Mike Pence for doing an absolutely incredible job at the head of the coronavirus task force. Donald Trump said, "Stand up, Mike. Great job." "We're here to discuss a monumental national achievement," Trump went on, describing the race for a vaccine with an exaggeration that veered back into Star Trek or even Buzz Lightyear territory. Before Operation Warp Speed, the typical time frame for development and approval, as you know, could be infinity. Trump then promised, this will vanquish the problem, this horrible scourge, as I call it, the China virus, because that's where it came from. Same moment that Donald Trump was dabbling in casual racism, Joe Biden was saying, "We're in a very dark winter. Things may well get worse before they get better. A vaccine may soon be available, but we need to level with one another. It will take longer than we would like to distribute it to all corners of the country. We'll need to persuade enough Americans to take the vaccine. Many have become cynical about its usefulness. It's daunting, but I promise you that we will make progress starting on day one. We didn't get into this mess quickly, and it's going to take time to fix it." Clenching both fists, Joe Biden added, "But we can do this. That's the truth, and telling you the truth is what this team, Vice President Elect Harris and I, will always do." Trump, meanwhile, sat at his now infamous tiny desk and signed a reportedly toothless executive order, which America First to the End is designed to give U.S. citizens priority access to vaccines before they are shipped abroad. Trump was joined on stage by a dozen officials, all but two of whom were men. They included his daughter and senior advisor, Ivanka. But they did not include the infectious disease expert, Anthony Fauci, who had evidently realized the real party is now happening somewhere else. Anthony Fauci popped up on screen at the Biden event in Wilmington, Delaware, stating, "I have been through many public health crises before, but this is the toughest one we've ever faced as a nation." The 45th and 46th presidents share a notoriety for gaffes. So far, both had managed to stay on script. But Donald Trump could not resist taking questions from the press. "Why," someone asked, "are you still hosting Christmas parties, despite public health guidelines discouraging them?" Trump insisted that there were far fewer Christmas parties and most people wore face masks. Then came the real question, why not include members of the Joe Biden transition team in this summit? Trump said, "Hopefully the next administration will be the Trump administration, because you can't steal hundreds of thousands of votes," the president said airily, despite the fact that he lost the November presidential election. "You can't have fraud and deception and all of the things that they did and then slightly win a swing state. And you just have to look at the numbers. Look at what's been on the tape. Look at all the corruption. And we'll see you can't win an election like that. So hopefully the next administration will be the Trump administration, a continuation." Donald Trump went on to extol that administration's glories, including a soaring stock market and a creation of a space force, as if these would be enough to make defeat mathematically impossible. For the record, though, the Homeland Security Department and the State Department have both debunked Donald Trump's election disinformation and found no significant evidence of either interference or fraud in the 3rd of November election. Change the channel at the moment, as many yearn to do, on his presidency, and you found Joe Biden's pick for Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, delivering an apt warning. The truth is that the best policies and the best vaccines and the best treatments will not heal our nation unless we overcome the fear, the anxiety, anger and distrust so many Americans are feeling right now. Does anyone have a vaccine for that? We'll be right back.
food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and let us begin the day by contemplating on a general advice from the Holy Prophet's first infallible heir, the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. He who adopts greed as a habit devalues himself. He who discloses his hardship agrees to humiliation. And he who allows his tongue to overpower his soul debases the soul.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah al-Aliyy al-Azim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyyina Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. Wa ala alihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin la siyama baqiyatillah fil aradin ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-sharif wa ja'alana min a'wanihi wa ansarih. Last night we spoke about the way that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has provided humanity with guidance for their personal progress and also for establishing a community, a universal community based on justice as a major value and other values that inshallah we will talk about it. When it comes to personal progress, all the prophets helped humanity in order to combat their ego, in order to combat temptations coming from their nafsa ammara, their commanding soul, from Satan. They try to take them from darkness to light. But when it comes to establishing a just society, it was the job of the messengers of the Rusul who were given the book and mizan, the scale or the balance, so that they would lead and guide humanity towards establishment of this social justice. لقد أرسلنا رسلنا بالبينات وأنزلنا معهم الكتاب والميزان ليقوم الناس بالقسط.
One of the beautiful verses of the Quran about this ummah which is going to be established, this community which is going to be established, is this ayah, Surah Baqarah, verse 143. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وكذلك جعلناكم أمة وسطا. This verse is preceded and followed by some sentences about the change of Qibla, direction of prayer. You know that Muslims initially were asked to say their prayer towards Baytul Muqaddas or Baytul Maqdis or Jerusalem. This was a sign of unity, a sign of saying that we should be praying towards the same direction. But this was not well received. Unfortunately, instead of appreciating this, they started saying that Muslims don't have Qibla of their own. They need us, they imitate us. Anyway, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala changed the direction. Of course, we believe that in the knowledge of Allah, this was from the eternity known. But that was a test to see who is going to accept and who is going to reject. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَكَذَلِكَ جَعَلْنَاكُمْ أُمَّةً وَسَطًا لَتَكُونُوا شُهَدَاءَ عَلَى النَّاسِ. This ayah is very important. We have made you in this way a middle, a balanced ummah, nation. Islamic community, Muslim ummah has to be balanced, has to find the middle position. Going to extremes has nothing to do with Islam and with the way that Allah has planned this religion. وَكَذَلِكَ جَعَلْنَاكُمْ أُمَّةً وَسَطًا.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here. Who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Of course, this Jal is Tashri'i, not Takwini. It means that this is legislative. It's not that Allah has created us to be balanced so that we cannot be anything else. This is the legislation of Allah. Allah has wanted us to be balanced. Allah has designed Islam in the way that we can be balanced. But if we misunderstand Islam or mispractice, then we end up with the situation that we have in the world today. That you see lots of problems and lack of balance, as I will mention, in Muslim ummah. And if the ummah is like what we see today, they don't represent Islam. At least parts of this ummah, they don't represent Islam. Because Allah has planned and designed this ummah. In other words, He has wanted this ummah to be balanced. Why?
Is it only for their own good? If you are not balanced, you would suffer. You know, if I eat too much, or if I eat nothing, I will suffer. If I don't work, or I work too much, I will suffer. If I pay no attention to my family, or I pay too much attention and I forget everything else, I will suffer. But here there is another factor, another thing. If our ummah is not balanced, not only we suffer, we would also lose an opportunity. What is that opportunity? That is the opportunity of being leader for other nations.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
O Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. O Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and Al Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. O Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallah Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. O Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away, please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. O Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again. 10 minutes.
Made in Israel.
The weapon that was used in nuclear scientist assassination was made in Israel. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was targeted on Friday, November 27th, in Absad city of Damavand County in the province of Tehran. Iran says that nuclear scientist assassinated east of Tehran province was shot by a remote-controlled machine gun operating out of another car. The weapon collected from the site of the terrorist act bears the logo and specifications of the Israeli military industry. Israel has had a big part to play in the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Israeli media said that a senior Israeli official told the US-based New York Times that the world should thank Israel for killing the Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Apparently, this anonymous official was reportedly involved in the program to track Fakhrizadeh for years. Fakhrizadeh's name was mentioned multiple times in a presentation in 2018 by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, during which he repeated baseless claims about the Iranian nuclear program. Netanyahu claimed that Israel stole thousands of secret documents on Iran's nuclear energy program. Netanyahu claimed that the nuclear scientist had notably worked from 1999 to 2003 on a secret military project called Ahmad. The aim, according to Netanyahu, was ultimately to produce five nuclear warheads in violation of Iran's international commitments. But under pressure from the United States, which had just invaded Iraq, the Islamic Republic had decided to end it. Iran said the whole presentation was fiction. Netanyahu, nonetheless, described the scientist as the director of Iran's nuclear program and threatened, remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Dr. Fakhrizadeh, and also, not coincidentally, many of Sepahan's key personnel worked under Fakhrizadeh. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Moreover, an unnamed Western intelligence source told Channel 12 the killing of the nuclear physicist was the pinnacle of Israel's long-term plans. Iranian Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council Ali Shamkhani says the MKO terrorist group was suspected alongside Israel in the killing of Fakhrizadeh. The enemy, according to Shamkhani, was targeting the Iranian nuclear scientist for decades. Israeli Energy Minister Yuval Steinitz told Israel's Khan public broadcaster that the assassination of Fakhrizadeh was a positive thing for the world. The assassination in Iran, whoever did it, it serves not only Israel, but the whole region and the world, Steinitz said. So far, Tel Aviv has not officially took claim for the attack. But there has been little formal comment from Israeli officials on the assassination. In a video uploaded to Twitter shortly after news of the assassination emerged, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, counting off various achievements of the week, noted that this was a partial list, as I can't tell you everything. It's all for you, citizens of Israel, for our country. It's a week of achievements, and there'll be more. According to Israel Channel 12, all Israeli embassies around the world are on high alert. Francis Lepointe International wrote that an Iranian expert who wishes to remain anonymous said that this is a very sophisticated attack on the part of Israel involving no less than 12 attackers. The information was given by the Mossad, who instructed the Iranians, members of the People's Mujahideen Organization, MKO terrorist group, to carry out the mission on the ground, according to the same source. He's referring to the MKO terrorist organization that has assassinated tens of thousands of Iranians since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979 in Iran. Iran says that Israeli intelligence were behind it. The New York Times confirms this, citing unnamed sources. According to the New York Times, one American official, along with two other intelligence officials, said that Israel was behind the attack on the scientist. Many things have been revealed in this assassination. Israeli and European newspapers were flooded with leaked reports confirming that the Mossad-affiliated Kidon assassination unit had a list of assassination operations at the top. This includes Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement. The list allegedly includes member of the Lebanese, Palestinian, Iraqi and Yemeni targets. The Israeli Mossad, in cooperation with its internal mercenaries in Lebanon, has not stopped its attempt to assassinate Sayed Hassan Nasrallah. But all these attempts have failed due to the security vigilance of his security apparatus. The British newspaper The Sunday Times confirmed that the details of the assassination that targeted Professor Fakhrizadeh and the use of the executed cell on motorcycles bear the fingerprints of the Israeli Kidon assassination unit. Raz Zimt, researcher specializing in Iran at the Institute for National Security Studies, INSS, in Tel Aviv, told the New York Times that only Israel and the U.S. have the capacity and the interest to do such a thing, Israel or the United States or both. If this was an Israeli hit, then surely it wasn't the first time. Raz Zimt also says that this situation worries Israel, which is trying to delay Iran's nuclear program, as we saw this summer at the Natanz power plant. On July 2nd, a huge explosion hit a center housing modern centrifuges at this uranium enrichment complex in central Iran. Well, one thing is for sure, Iran will not stop its nuclear energy activities. This is one of Iran's responses to this assassination. In fact, a bill requiring Iran's government to step up uranium enrichment cleared its first hurdle in parliament. Iran's nuclear energy program is already advanced, and this assassination won't do anything in terms of hampering Iran's efforts. It only further exposed Iran's enemies and how far they would go to jeopardize the security of their countries with the aim of ulterior motives.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions, Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. More than 250 scientists and scholars from 30 countries have signed an open letter calling on policymakers to engage more with the growing risk of societal disruption and collapse due to damage to the climate and environment, arguing that only then might communities and nations begin to prepare and so reduce its likelihood, speed, severity, harm to the most vulnerable and to nature. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Corbett, writer. This article is published under the heading, As World Teeters on Brink, over 250 scientists and scholars warn of full-fledged societal collapse. Here's the details of this article. More than 250 scientists and scholars from 30 countries have issued an open letter calling on policymakers to engage more with the growing risk of societal disruption and collapse due to damage to the climate and environment, arguing that only then might communities and nations begin to prepare and so reduce its likelihood, speed, severity, and harm to the most vulnerable and to nature. The letter, a version of which appeared in The Guardian recently, comes on the heels of a pair of United Nations reports warning of the dire direction in which the planet is headed. As UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres put it, the state of the planet is broken. Humanity is waging war on nature. This is suicidal. After failing in the recent years since then to cut greenhouse gas emissions in line with that accord, the letter says, we must now face the consequences. While some armed services already see collapse as an important scenario requiring planning, the letter notes that the topic is not well reported in the media and mostly absent from civil society and politics, even though such collapse is already the experience or memory of many communities in the global south. The UK arm of Extinction Rebellion shared pieces of the letter on Twitter with photos of climate activists around the world demanding urgent action, denouncing media coverage that typically cites people who condemn discussion of the topic. The letter says that ill-informed speculation, such as on foreign misinformation campaigns or impacts on mental health and motivation, we will not support serious discussion. Rather, such claims risk betraying the thousands of activists and community leaders whose anticipation of collapse is part of their motivation to push for change on climate, ecology, and social justice. The letter continues, people who care about environmental and humanitarian issues should not be discouraged from discussing the risks of societal disruption or collapse that could risk agendas being driven by people with less commitment to such values. Some of us believe that a transition to a new form of society may be possible that will involve bold action to reduce damage to the climate, nature, and other people, including preparations for major disruptions, everyday life. We are united in regarding efforts to suppress discussion of collapse as hindering the possibility of that transition. We have experienced how emotionally challenging it is to recognize the damage being done along with the growing threat to our own way of the life, the letter concludes. We also know the great sense of fellowship that can rise. It is time to invite each other into difficult conversations so we can reduce our complicity in the harm and be creative to make the best of a turbulent future, the letter adds. Signatories and supporters of the letter shared it on social media with the hashtag #ScholarWarming, offering their summaries of what the letter calls for and detailing why they signed onto it. We are saying we must confront the real possibility of climate collapse so that we can do our utmost to avoid it. American climate scientist Peter Kalmus, a signatory to the letter, said in a tweet on Sunday, December 6th. This is as far from doomerism as you can get it. In a statement, University of Cumbria professor James Bendel, another signatory, explained that we come from dozens of countries and subject disciplines and perceive a resistance by the establishment to serious engagement and adapting to the increasing disruptions to food, water, health, and the economy. It is time to listen to the scholarship, Bendel added, and try to reduce harm from societal disruption and even collapse.